So you are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. And before we begin office hour today, I want to remind you that the views that are contained in this hour may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So it's Tuesday. It's 5 o'clock. This is Professor J, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And we are ready, as we always do at 5 o'clock on Tuesdays, to go and knock on a door on campus to have an office hour. And you hear there we're knocking on the door. We're saying, what are all these people doing in all these beautiful buildings? What are they thinking about? This is public affairs. So we're bringing to the public some of the stuff that goes on, I wouldn't say in secret, but sometimes in secret, in hidden behind the closed office doors. What are faculty thinking about? What are they researching? What do they have to tell us? What intriguing questions do they have to offer for us? And I'm very excited today that we're going to go to the world of theater. And we're going to interview my friend, Peter Lichtenfels, who is in the Department of Theater. So first of all, we want to say hello, Peter.
Thank you.
Right. So, and as always, before we get involved in talking about sort of some of the particular issues that he's been thinking about in what's now 50 years of directing theater, so we got a real font of all kinds of information for us today and all kinds of thoughts. We always start here on Office Hour with the same question, which is very intriguing to all of us. How do people end up doing what they do? And certainly in this case, how does someone make the decision to spend their life in the world of theater and feel like ready to do it, and not as an actor, but in this case as somebody who wants to be a director, someone directing? So can you tell us a little bit about your path, how you ended up as a director?
My parents never went to theater, and I don't come from a theater background in that way. What happened was that I went to university, and we had Frosh Week in my first year. And it just so happened that the senior student that was looking after six of us, random ones, also happened to be in theater. And so I was going to do French and intellectual history. And she said, well, why don't you take a theater course? And I thought, oh, French and intellectual history is going to be really hard. I'll take a basket weaving course, so to speak. And so I took a theater course, never knowing anything about it.
This was as a freshman?
As a freshman, first day. And I went in there. And so at the end of that week, the whole class was assigned to go see this play in the middle of the city that I was studying in. So I went. And it was a George Bernard Shaw play. And I respect George Bernard Shaw, but I wouldn't put him at the top of my table. And it was that moment, that evening, on what I was seeing on stage, and I knew that's what I wanted to do for my life. And so from that day onward, from that moment onward, I took theater courses. I told everybody that, you know, I wanted to become a director. And then you kind of you say things, but then you work towards the saying or the word, and then it becomes a reality after a while. You know, so that's how it happened.
So you saw that play and you had a real aha, life-changing experience.
Totally.
So,
that's
quite interesting. I wonder, from seeing a play like that, why in particular you wanted to become a director. I mean, there are many other things you might have thought about doing when you see a play. So, in other words, I'm not even sure how much you would know on the first time you see a play that there was a director or that somebody was doing that. But somehow the directing aspect of it, did that speak to you that early also?
Totally. That moment, without actually knowing really a lot about what a director does, except that I knew that I didn't want to be on the stage. I didn't want to be an actor. You know, I didn't want to be a designer. But the sense of marshalling all those forces and collaborating with all those forces to put something up on stage, that's what I wanted to do. You know, I didn't know how what I was seeing happened, but I wanted to be there and make something like that happen.
So you wanted to be kind of the impetus behind, that you said, behind the action, mm-hmm. which raises our first big question for us mm-hmm. this afternoon. I think if I ask my students about directing, I think they have an idea of movie directors, because we mm-hmm. see those pictures of them sitting in those special chairs, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. telling people how to run the cameras and mm-hmm. all of that, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that if I ask my students what theater directors do, I'm not mm-hmm. sure they would really have much of an idea mm-hmm. of what a theater director does, mm-hmm. unless maybe they'd happened to have been in a play once and worked with a director. I think that's a fairly unclear job description mm-hmm. for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about that a little bit, but maybe we can start with just if somebody asks you sort of generally, what is a director's role, what you might sort of give somebody a down and dirty, getting them to think about that job. What is a director's task mm-hmm. in theater in comparison to something like in, they don't pick the camera angles and things like that they do in film.
No. I think historically the director is the person who, I imagine something like a music conductor, that you marshal the orchestra and the energies and the forces within the orchestra against a libretto or a script, mm-hmm. and then bring that into fruition in front of an audience. What you learn them, you know, on the way is, in theater, there's lights involved, there's probably sound involved, there's sets involved, there's props involved, there are certainly actors involved, mm-hmm. and then how do you bring that all together? Yeah, mm-hmm. I think when I started, there was still this fantasy or this kind of thing that you came away with right away, is that the director is a I don't know, a dictator, his word or her word can't be brooked, kind uh-huh. of, you are the fount of inspiration and all of that. And that's kind of what I've gone away from. Mm-hmm. You know, I was never that, because that's not who I am, mm-hmm. you know. And so how do you build things collaboratively, and how do you work with various areas to bring them the energies to fruition and to a height all at the same time is much more what I'm interested in, but not involving myself directly in you do this, you do that, like Martinet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's an interesting analogy for us to start with, mm-hmm. is the musical conductor, mm-hmm. because I do think we have the image of the musical conductor mm-hmm. as somebody who does have a lot of say. I mean, think of the famous, we think of these famous conductors in music as being mm-hmm. quite opinionated individuals mm-hmm. who have styles. And mm-hmm. so I think we mm-hmm. do see them very much as mm-hmm. sort of the traffic cop, as you say, sort mm-hmm. of person who makes a lot of decisions and has quite mm-hmm. a lot of ego investment, and who also gets a lot of glory. Mm-hmm. Certainly in the world of music. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that interests me specifically about your work and about some of the articles that I read about your sort of theory of directing is that you do reject that whole approach mm-hmm. of the, you know, George Schulte, the famous conductor, mm-hmm. and you go for something that's more collaborative. I think this will be very interesting to our listening audience, because when I hear you make that idea, it isn't really clear to me what does that mean. What does it mean to do collaboration? Because you're sort of in charge, mm-hmm. you know, but what does it mean to work collaboratively? So maybe we want to start off with your article when you talk about Cantor, mm-hmm. Cantor's director, your article about the Polish director, Cantor, Tadeusz Cantor, who from 1975 and died in 1992.
That's when I saw him.
Oh, that's when you saw him. I think certainly for our listening audience, this would give us a very different model of what does it mean to be a theater director. So mm-hmm. we're really going, because in his, when he was a director, he remained on the stage during the play with the actors, at least right. for the plays you were talking mm-hmm. about. And I was quite struck when I read that, it just seems very unusual. And what was the point? I know the actors are supposed to be on the stage, but I had never heard before about the idea of also having the director on stage. So I think that'll lead us into this question about collaboration. What's the point of having the director on the stage during the show while the actors are there?
I mean, the first thing I saw, thought, because I was also quite young when I saw Cantor for the first time, is I'd never seen a director on stage before. And I thought, God, that guy's got a big ego, you know?
So the first thing you thought of was that he was hogging the stage.
Totally big. And it took me, I mean, it didn't take me any time. Once I saw the show going up, you know, what he was doing with his group of Polish actors was so mesmerizing and such skill that I just went to a different place. But I'd lived, I lived with him, and I chose to live with his work, meaning that's how I lived with him for many years, you know. And what I came to understand, especially because he'd videoed all his productions in that time, and you certainly got to look at what he was doing on stage. And he had a different function that... I think sometimes when you have actors on stage and then you tell the story, you get lost in the story, right? The story is the believability, it's the reality, yeah? But when the director is on stage and has a function, it's you're always seeing the play through the actors, but you're also seeing the play through the director. You can't help it. And so you always understand that the play is in process and is a collaboration, and there's a to and fro between the actors and the director, and that stops you kind of losing yourself in the world, uncritically. And you constantly kind of see that, oh, this is something that has been thought through, that's being rehearsed, that is being presented, something like that.
So I think that's a very interesting point. What you're saying is that if the director isn't on the stage, you get caught up in the narrative. Basically, the narrative has a power.
Yeah, that's the danger, I think, for the or the liberation for the audience. Yeah, they get lost directly into their world, and by Cantor being on stage, you can't lose yourself.
Because you're looking at it, and at the same time that you might be caught up in the story, all of the time you're seeing somebody from behind the scenes. So it's kind of destabilizing. Would that be a way you could say, sort of destabilizing the tendency to just say, "Oh, I'm just going to sit here and watch this story unfold." And so it's kind of like, I mean, the example I thought about a little bit was the Pompidou Center in Paris, where they put the sort of the inside, what we think of as the pipe structures and the inside of the building, on the outside of the building. So when you look at it, you see the inside on the outside. And when I was reading your article about Cantor, I thought that's sort of similar in the sense that something that usually is on the inside in theater, the sort of hidden, the director part, how things work, how water goes up and down around the building. But now suddenly that's on the outside, and that changes your view.
Absolutely. And, you know, once you embrace that way of looking at a piece of theater, it becomes really fascinating, because you're seeing the craftedness of it as you're also losing yourself, or as you're also engaged in the storytelling of it.
So you have to explain that to us. What do you mean? I mean, I understand when you look at the building, you see the inside of the building on the outside, and it sort of changes the way you look at the building.
It's not hidden.
It's not hidden. But when it comes to theater, what is the point of seeing the craft on display? How does that change your relationship to the play when the craft is on display?
That this is a work that you're seeing people working, and I mean, and they're acting, and they're creating worlds, but they're worlds that people create, not that you lose yourself in the character or that. And so that you can never you can never go to that place, you know, of fiction or imagination, you know, mm-hmm. without responsibility. Mm-hmm. And it, I think the great thing about it is it makes you think about yourself. You know, it makes you think about that you're part. What he calls one of his plays is a séance. Yeah, and a séance, you know, is the word as we know it, but it's also a place where you sit together to talk. Mm. Yeah, that's a different definition of a séance, and in a way, that's what Cantor's productions are like. You don't literally talk, but you as the audience. And he as a person and the actress as a person sit down together and they engage mm-hmm. in the evening's talk.
So, I mean, in some ways, it's almost a counterintuitive point you're making, which is that the craft, showing the craft, letting the craft of theater being on display there for everybody actually sort of involves people in the play more, not less. It's not that the craft pushes you away. It's that it sort of sucks you in.
Totally.
So that's Cantor's understanding. And that Absolutely. So that we, when we're sitting there watching the play and we're seeing how the play is made,
yes.
as they say, how the yeah. sausage is made, then we become more engaged with it than otherwise.
Absolutely.
Now, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about when you're in this more engaged way in the theater and you see mm-hmm. the director there. What is it that you get that you might not get otherwise? Besides, as you say, you're not swept away by it. You're more. So, mm-hmm. are you more thinking about it more? Are you more? You know, what? How is this more deeper engagement manifest in your experience? Are you going to have a more emotional experience, or how does that? How would you try to characterize for us what is new or different then?
I think when I see Cantor, he comes from Poland, mm-hmm. yeah, and so he was born I think around 1910, and he lived through the First World War as a kid, and then lived as an adult through the Second World War, and so. The religion of Judaism and Catholicism, the Nazism, the rebuilding, all of those things go through his plays, mm-hmm. you know, and they talk about and they you have Polish culture like big songs and umpa bands and things like that, and so it's very stirring as well, you know. But what's interesting, the actors don't play realism either. They play, I don't know, they're almost like dolls. And by here, I don't mean Barbie or things. What I mean is that you cannot enter them. And, that, you know, like I'm Peter. You don't get to meet Peter. You know, there's you can go to the face. You can go to the persona. But then you watch what the persona does rather than go through what they might feel. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So they never invite you into those emotional areas that are so much loved in American theater.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
they keep you at that distance. And part of the keeping you at the distance is bravura acting, or that's able to. But part of it also is that you have to deal with it. You know, mm-hmm. And you have to make something of mm-hmm. what it's like, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good way of putting it. If we think about what we've said so far, having this craft more on display mm-hmm. in the theater makes additional demands mm-hmm. on the audience. And mm-hmm. that's what you're saying. That it actually demands from the audience, you think you could just sit here and be entertained. Forget it.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to just entertain you. We're going to demand that you participate. And maybe this goes back to your original point about trying to have more participation by a director. Mm-hmm. And oddly enough, we come around to that point that mm-hmm. one thing that people have to participate more because they have to do more work to have their experience of the play, have their interpretation. They have to do more work to make sense of it, or...
I don't know, you know, when I'm watching a Cantor, I don't know whether I can honestly say I made sense of it, but, you know, what I saw at every moment was enormous skill and craft of highly accomplished people singing or dancing or acting, you know, so that whatever happened on stage, you know, I could never say, oh, this is... they're not doing this well or whatever, or I don't understand it. It must be because they're not doing it well or something. You know, they're doing it brilliantly. And so even though they, you know, they don't kind of invite me in for a cup of tea and a piece of cake, but just it's bravura what I'm seeing. It's amazing. Yeah. Then you even if you don't understand it, you understand the sheer quality of it. Yeah. And that is something that makes you stick with it. Because if you don't understand it, well, what is it that I have to learn? Or how do I begin to engage with this material? But you can't engage with it on an emotional, I like it or I don't like it. You have to engage it with it on what are all the forces at play and what are they doing in this, including Cantor.
And it sounds like, again, for the audience, there's a lot of forces that then get engaged.
Yeah.
That, and that's again why it's demanding to be, to go to this, to sit in this. It's not the easiest theater to watch.
No. It's cultural. In Poland, it's perfectly fine because you're going for a conversation.
Ah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not as I'm going to, not in the American sense of I want to be entertained and I want to leave the world behind and that. In the Polish theater, you kind of engage with the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And, you know, it's done on the motif of circus.
Mm.
Yeah? Not three-ring circus, but the circus of life or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so that people do have that cultural affinity more.
So, and this whole complicated relationship then between the director on stage and the audience that then takes up the task of being amazed and thinking about it all. You discuss in the article that some of this may come from Cantor having been an artist, a painter. So there, if somebody was saying, you know, what's the model for being a director? If we're not looking for George Schulte and the big, you know, bravura person of music conductor, instead we're looking for a certain kind of practitioner, you know, a painter. So maybe you could say a little bit for us about how it is that the fact that he painted influenced, which I think would be quite surprising for the listeners to think about, that somehow being a painter is a kind of a model for being a director.
Absolutely. He was a part of his craft was painting. I mean, he has this lovely painting in the play he died in. He had a painting called "I Want to Get Out of This Painting." You know, and of course, it happened. But he has that painterly world. But he also worked with found junk. And turned it into
collages
then turned in after, you know, Poland was one of the countries that was most affected by the Second World War in terms of people and in terms of fighting on its land. So that how do you rebuild in that? And part of his was rebuilding and making art through junk that he found, broken tanks, umbrellas and that. And then putting that and making art out of that. Yeah. And then that's his actors were roughly the same age as him, some maybe 10 years younger. And they were together for like 40 years. And so they built up a huge relationship. But he was always the painter, the artist, the whoever.
The person who brings the things together.
Yeah.
The director not is someone who takes the big stance in terms of having a big ego, but the person who brings all the found objects together into the collage.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that Cantor did have a pretty big ego.
After everything we said. After everything we said, he did have a big ego. Okay. Okay. So this is not, the secret Peter is revealing to the radio today, that the directors do have big egos in theater as well.
Absolutely. You have to have strength, you know. Uh-huh. And when he was on stage, he wasn't a big ego. You know, the actors really had the prime of it. But it was totally constructed.
Well, great. Well, we've come to the end of the segment one of Office Hour today. So we're going to talk more with Peter Lichtenfels about a modern theater and being a director. So stay with us, and we will be back in just a minute. So welcome back to segment two of Office Hour today. This is Professor Jay. And we're talking about some very intriguing questions about going to the theater. And I already have a whole different idea than I had before about being part of the audience. Well, with Peter Lichtenfels as a 50 years of directing. So this is someone who's thought a lot about directing. And we were talking about a Polish director who actually got on stage with his actors, which then changed, presumably, the relationship for everybody. It changed theater for the actors. It changed theater for him. It changed theaters for the audience. Now, one of the other areas in which you've done a lot of thinking, which I find very interesting, is this cross-cultural question. Mm-hmm. Almost everything that I read of your sort of thinking about the theater is about this question of how theater transfers from one culture to another. Mm-hmm. With your examples, we will talk about with taking Shakespeare to China, and Japanese theater. And before we go into the particular examples that you wrote about and that you also did, that you directed in your life, I'm just curious, when we think about cross-cultural artistic exchange in general, how you think theater fits into that. I naively, before I read these articles, I thought about theater as something beyond the language barrier. I understand that's language barrier, but that theater had, we often think of theater being something that everybody does, that's found ubiquitously in many cultures. So I was surprised to see so many questions come up about how theater moves from culture to culture. So maybe just a couple general thoughts first about how come it turns out that theater is actually more complicated to move from culture to culture?
When I teach theater, right? And my favorite one I teach is the one where it began with the Greeks and
the Greeks,
the no theater in Japan and a puppet theater in Indonesia and that, and what are the many expressions people have of telling stories of their culture. And so that's always intrigued me, and it's been for me it's been a great kind of, and it's still a great learning curve, because I go into areas like India, and I learn a totally different way of they wanting their stories told to them from European ways, and then growing up in Europe was also very lucky, because the countries are smaller and the cultures are more distinct than the North America of Canada and United States together and things. So the chance to learn about different ways of doing thing is much greater, and not as scary, or not feeling that there's a one way or only a few ways. You know, there's many, many ways to tell stories.
Okay, well, give us some examples so that the listeners can understand what you're talking about in terms of what's the difference between, because I think maybe we think narrative moves fairly easily from one culture to the culture. If we're just translating narratives, we can read. Just think, if we go into the library, the bookstore, there are stories from all over the world, all around for us to read, and they don't need too much more rather than just the translation from one language to the next. But when it comes to theater, it seems like it takes more translation in some ways, again, that I think I hadn't thought about a lot, and I imagine that the listeners hadn't thought about it, that there's more to culturally specific notions of being a director, for example, Or things like that, the audience expectations being much more different from culture to culture. Mm-hmm. So maybe give us an example where you went and you found something really totally surprising about the way they did culture that you felt was really foreign from what you were used to.
Well, the first time I went to Japan and I went to see a no play, as an example, I'm game to see anything, but I went there. Uh-huh. And I sat through 2 hours of nothing that I understood, you know. But I could tell you what physically happened, but not. It was in Japanese, you know. So there was the way the story was being told was not the same. You know, after a while, I found out that there are only two characters, and one of them is dead. You know, uh-huh. And so. Unless you begin to understand that, and they rather in the West, in the United States, in England, wherever, you play actions. I'm going to make love to you. I'm going to kill you. Mm-hmm. In Japanese theater, you know, they do reactions. Mm. You know, the event has already happened, and you see how the person reacts to it. You know, so it's that.
That's a good example. Mm-hmm. Well, I asked you for an example, Peter. Okay. You came up with a very good, that was a very good example. I think that's very clear for the listeners that the difference is that it really isn't like one story translating from place to place. Mm-hmm. It's even the notion of what is the story about? What mm-hmm. is theater about? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can help us a little bit to understand the Japanese example there. If there the example is you don't want to know what happens so much, but you want to know how people reacted to what happened. Were you able to connect these different notions of theater and storytelling with cultural elements, or why did we end up with, or is that just such a gigantic big question that we don't really know, even in our own culture, how our story, you know, why we find such a different idea about theater?
For me, it's always humility. How do you want to have your stories told? Again, in India, you know, it's again very different.
Yes.
You know, much more to do with dance and much more to do with constant singing. And
yes.
Yeah. So you just have to not protect or embrace where you come from, but certainly honor it and then open up. Mm-hmm. To see what else is there.
Mm-hmm. Well, the India example is another very interesting example because mm-hmm. I know exactly what you mean in terms of the way in which we find in the what we would think of as sort of theater being the nexus of a lot of art forms.
Right.
Whereas maybe our culture theater would seem to us to be a little bit more monochrome in mm-hmm. terms of how we separate out artistic things. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's something to do about our culture as well, that we mm-hmm. kind of... You can only think of one thing. You can't chew gum.
We've had presidents like that.
Exactly. So there's a way in which we have to make theater more accessible mm-hmm. in that way. So let's go into some other examples of this cross-cultural question in a little bit more detail. Mm-hmm. And the first one is this one about when you took Shakespeare to China.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I wouldn't have thought of it as being as difficult. And you talked about the fact that the role of the director is just so different in Chinese mm-hmm. theater mm-hmm. that your kind of being a director was a challenge for the actors mm-hmm. who were used to something more traditional Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe you want to talk a little bit about that and then how you dealt with the cross-cultural director problem.
Mm-hmm. First of all, I was invited to Shanghai to direct, so it's not like I brought it, you know. And it was also a time when it's changed a little bit now, where the Chinese wanted to do everything, you know, and learn everything Western. You know, I mean, the way I came to know some people is because there was a Chinese delegation who came to UC Davis, you know, took a look at the theater department. Everybody had two cameras going click, click, click. And then when you got back 5 years later, that's what was being built in China. You know, they were westernizing. So part of my doing Shakespeare is so they could learn how a Westerner does Shakespeare. But I only learned that after the fact. You know, for me, it was just a challenge and a joy to see how I would or could work with a different culture.
Uh-huh.
Again, the theater in China is, the historical theater is much more Chinese opera, acrobatics and that.
Yes.
And they're only, you know, within the last, I don't know, say 20 years or 25 years, have they really started doing Western theater the way I understand Western theater to be, you know, borrow it, the lights, the whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so... There's I had a really tough time with Chinese because of culture.
Mm.
Yeah, that they wanted to be told what to do. Yeah, and the thing that I'm always very strong about is I never tell you what to do. I tell you what not to do, but I don't tell you what to do. You know, and when you do it, then I'll know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so they felt that I just didn't know how to direct, you know, and with being told, like, you know, a regimen, stay here, stand here, talk louder, look up stage or whatever, they felt they were just in a kind of morass.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I would work with little things and they wouldn't work for me, you know, and they never said no, they just didn't do anything. Yeah, and it took like 5 weeks of my not moving that they began to believe me, and then they started to work a little bit. And I mm-hmm. had these two actors who played Puck and Oberon, who started working, you know. And then because they were the leaders of the company, the others began to start working, and they kept saying, "This is a terrible play," and the administration would walk down to me saying, "Oh, we're throwing all this money in here.
What are you guys doing?"
Yeah, yeah. and the same with the actors. And then, you know, the little bits that I did, you know, started being knitted together in the last 4 days, 5 days before we started doing dress rehearsals. And you know, then people started coming in from the other end of the building telling the actors, "This is a really good show.
This is
good."
Know?
And then the audience just laughed and loved it, and they had a hit. And they were totally bemused because they had never been through that process.
Right.
And I didn't know any better. Mm-hmm. I don't know what their mm-hmm. process was. You know, so that was kind of part of the culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great story. It's actually mm-hmm. a great story of cultural exchange.
Yeah.
Because there you are. They wanted something. They brought you in because they had an idea of what they wanted. And then for your own reasons, you didn't conform mm-hmm. to exactly what it is they wanted. But it's a very optimistic story. And actually, there's a lot of optimism in all of your articles mm-hmm. when you talk about these cross-cultural experiences in the theater. That this is an area, even though it's extremely different, and mm-hmm. that it's a capacity to cooperate and to learn mm-hmm. and to grow and to make this show. And this is one of mm-hmm. these optimistic stories, because they managed to. Now, you didn't stay on stage with them. That would have been too much for them, probably, right?
not during the performance.
Not during the performance.
No, but afterwards, right. when I got like 60 dozens bouquets of flowers
right.
and things like that.
But this, so that you brought your style
mm-hmm.
and they learned this cooperative style, which you talked about mm-hmm. since the beginning of the hour, that there's something relentlessly cooperative mm-hmm. about the way that you want to direct. Mm-hmm. And they managed to join you in that and mm-hmm. do some of that work through the willingness of some of the actors to engage. So mm-hmm. that's really... Now, if... again, if
or
we try...
Or maybe through fear.
Or maybe through fear. So what, again, to try to characterize so we understand a little better, what is it that you were looking for when you wanted this collaboration? Some of the words that you use in the phrase is that you wanted something real. That's a pretty loaded phrase. Mm. You say, theater is a place where... possibilities, the impossibilities become real.
Mm-hmm.
Real is something that's really happening. So I'm curious how you can sort of explain that. What is real, certainly in terms of theater, which we don't really think of as being real
mm-hmm.
in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. When I fail as a director, is when I tell you something to do something and you do it.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I feel, oh, you're not doing your own thing. You're doing my thing.
Okay.
You know, and then I feel false already, you know, because...
You're manipulating me.
Yeah, and that. And so what I work on is you find it.
Mm.
You find it. And when you find something that works, I'll tell you. I'll reflect you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? It to you. And when they do that, often they really do find that they're empowered, you know, and that I'm not one of the directors who's really a traffic cop, you know, that I'm giving them their voice.
Mm.
And when I talk about real, I talk about that process where they find it and they make it. Yeah. So the process is real and craft, you know, crafted, not... I don't mistake reality in midstream. You know, it's a show.
Right.
Yeah, does that make any sense?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think it's a challenge. I think it's a challenge for us theater goers and to think about the points, your ideas there that, and I imagine it's a challenge for the actors as well, because mm-hmm. I think it's easier for someone, and certainly this is true of so many situations we live in life, including in our teaching situation, it's much easier just to tell people what to do, and students find that reassuring. And when you talk about the anxiety the directors, your actors have, it reminds me of the anxiety my students have sometimes when you say, I'm not going to tell you what to do. Then they freak out and they say, oh, but I don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But so you're looking for them, they're stepping in some way, and this I think is a really an important question for our, as an institution, you know, our university as an institution, giving people the opportunity to step into a role in a way that is real for them, and what that will then, how much more meaningful that will be for them. But
absolutely.
I imagine that's difficult.
It's hugely difficult. And it, you know, like anything that's difficult, you kind of, it's the last place you go unless you have, until you have no more choice.
Exactly. You, know? You ask the professor over and over again. And finally, when the professor says, no, you have to do this yourself and figure it out for yourself.
That's
then
it.
Finally they go and they do it.
And then they begin to believe you.
Yes.
And then they begin to feel that it's not so frightening, you know, and then once they do, and once they're flying, like some of them do fly, then they don't listen to you anymore, you know? And that's great, because they've taken the commitment.
Yes.
Yeah, you can then tell them, oh, this or that, but you're collaborating.
So how do we find that moment? You say that, you know, when there's nothing more for you to do, what is that moment? I think this is a really important question that I'm sure all of our... all of the listeners are really interested in that moment when you find something, a place for yourself, when it takes off for you in some way that we would call real now, that, you know, then what happens to you as a director then, or us, is that you just step back because it's there, but... How does that happen? I mean, I'm wondering if you can give me, I'm thinking about teaching as you're talking about directing, and I'm wondering what ideas I can steal from you about how do you get people, you know, how does the director not impinge upon the actors then? Because it's so easy to impinge upon them. You are the director for, you know, that's what you are.
I certainly have ideas, you know, if they ask me, well, what does this line say or mean, I can give them that.
So you tell them, you go over the lines
I don't go over lines. I ask them, I go through every word with them and ask them, what does this word mean? What does this word do? Or not necessarily mean, but what does this word do? Or what does this word do? And I go through every word so that I know they've made a choice. You know, and then it'll come about, because if they understand the choice and perform it, then they own it and then they can sell it to the audience. What I'm, you know, when I'm on stage, I work with the, or in the rehearsal room, I work with the actors, but what I really care about is the audience, you know, and what the audience experiences, you know, and unless, if the actor knows what they're doing, if they own it, then they'll be able to, play it to the audience. If they're playing Peter's version, you know, then it may be still very good, don't know, but it won't be them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that level of potential energy, storytelling, having a dialogue with the audience, you mm-hmm. know, like emotional or whatever those kind of affective dialogues are, they won't happen.
Hmm. Well, that's a very interesting way of putting that. So I just want to go back and really clarify that, because I've never quite thought about it that way before. What you're doing when you're going over this script with them, then mm-hmm. the role of you as, in your vision of, as a director, mm-hmm. is you're helping them think, what does this word do? Mm-hmm. And then you're seeing, you're helping them realize that whatever they are always doing things mm-hmm. with the language. Mm-hmm. And a play is a lot of doing. Mm-hmm. And there's always going to be an infinite number of choices of what they do. Mm-hmm. So when they commit to a doing, mm-hmm. their own form of doing mm-hmm. around the script, mm-hmm. they've in a sense kind of directed themselves.
Absolutely.
Could you even say it that way?
Yeah, you can. Uh-huh. You just did.
But, I wasn't sure it made any sense, yeah, but
no,
I like
no,
it. I
no,
like
no,
it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like it.
No, because they own it. So, and that the word doing is really important because, you know, usually people say, oh, what does it mean? What does it mean?
Yes.
And, you know, our job is to do and leave the meaning to the audience.
Aha. Uh-huh.
You know?
Aha. Uh-huh. Wow. Okay. That's another interesting way to think about it. Mm-hmm. So you as the director are not concerned about meaning because the meaning is the work of the audience. Is that
what it means is the audience's job. What our job is to do.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Cause if we say we mean, oh, I mean this, then where does the audience's imagination get in there?
Uh-huh.
You know, cause you're telling them,
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You know?
Well, that's a lot of work. You really have the audiences. I'm exhausted. I can feel yeah, by the end. They have to do all of this. They have to figure things out. They're revealed. Nothing is hidden for them, so they don't get to get swept up in the story, and they have to come up with their own meaning.
And I'm always very nice, low keyed, and patient, and unmovable.
What does that mean? It sounds like a bit of a complicated mm-hmm. question, but what does it mean to say that the meaning is in the audience? In other words, are you talking sort of about the ultimate the interpretation of what the story does is located in the audience? Is that?
Our job is to have a real conversation on stage, like not just say, oh, these words and these words, but, you do something with those words, of course, energetically. The story itself, like Midsummer's Dream, Romeo and Juliet, I don't know, Hamlet, yeah? I mean, everywhere you go in the world, every year, there's kind of hundreds of Hamlets happening,
yes, yes.
You know, 400 or 500 yes. years after it was written.
Yes.
You know, so it still hasn't been mined.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Well, what makes, when you're thinking about directing then, mm-hmm. what are you, I mean, this may be an impossible to answer, but why not? We like to ask impossible questions on the show. What are you looking for in a script then? Are you looking for a script that you feel the words do a lot of things so that the audience can find a lot of potential meaning in it?
When I do a script, it's because I want to hang out there for a while. Yeah, because there's so much meat or enjoyment or what have you. You know, and work that I can do with the actors on it. And after that, and I care about it. You know, mm-hmm. I'm affected. I think it's a really interesting story and there's things I can do. So I'm passionate about that, you know, and that's why they're there, because I'm passionate about it,
mm-hmm.
yeah? But then I just hope that when the audience comes, that because we've really done our work, you know, that they can then enjoy their side of the story or create a story for themselves of what Hamlet means.
And it might be different than yours.
Totally.
Right. But again, so what you're saying there for the script is that there's something in the script that speaks to you, as you use the word passion, that there's some kind of just engagement script.
Yeah.
I think that's I very somewhat vague in terms of thinking. I mean, maybe it's enough. I mean, I've never had that. I've never thought about. We are. I think most of us listeners are just consumers of theater in a very different way. We just go and we assume somebody else has picked it because it's important, and therefore we go because it's important in some way.
Yeah, I don't think whatever I said 2 minutes ago. I don't think it's I pick it because it's important, but it talks to me.
It talks to you.
It talks to the actors. So I'm hoping it talks to the audience. Yeah, when I'm working with the actors. I do a lot of work where they don't tell the audience what it is, you know, not as in I'm hiding something, but as in I've thought about it, it's a done deal, and you're getting my complete thoughts kind of tied up in a nice ribbon for you to package, you know, and the ribbon, what the present is, I want the audience to wrap that present up by themselves and tie the ribbon, you know, and make their own present out of it. Does that make any sense?
Well, I think it's a fantastic image. I think it's a wonderful image, and I'm very intrigued by it. I'm not sure exactly. I'm thinking about my experiences in the play, whether going to the theater, wrapping it up, and about that I'm sort of wrapping it up in my own way. I think, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about is that I'm going to have to be a lot more active in the theater when I go, because I'm going to, there's a lot of more things that you have to do watching a play. I do wonder, just sort of generally, I'm sure many of our listeners have gone to a show and found it somewhat bewildering. I think there's theater that is just not clear, or they don't quite understand it. And certainly, what we've been talking about, some of these shows are quite, as you say, demanding of the audience in some ways. I wonder if there's anything that you can say to sort of help us think about how to go to the theater. We now have we have many ideas about what the director does. The director is very collaborative. The director is trying not to, tell the actors what to do, is trying not to oversimplify a narrative and make it so that you're just going to be entertained. They're trying to open up a lot of space for the audience to have a complicated experience in relationship to the play, how do we do that? I mean, how does the audience, you know, what would you tell me to help us understand how to be a good audience? Or is there no concept like that at all, really?
Like, you can go to audience school and get better.
Yeah. Well,
I think that often when theater disappoints, it's because the energy in the show is something that the audience already has in themselves. So they come off the street with the trouble of the day, and they go into the theater, and nothing changes. I think the audience goes to the theater because they want to be energized. Energized through stories, energized through how hard the actors are working, you know, or putting out, you know, just that what they're seeing is greater than the social life they bring with them into the auditorium. And that once they feel that, and when they feel that, you know, you get refreshed, feel you've had a holiday, or, you know, you feel awake when you leave. You know, within 2 minutes of going in the theater and what the energy is like, and you think, okay, I've, you know, spend another $25 or whatever, and it's not going to be a great night, you know. But when you get the great night, it's like, whoa, you know, and you just forget. It transports you.
Well, it's certainly true in your case, because you gave us the example of going to a play and then that changing your life. So if that's sort of our highest level of audience engagement, okay, next time you go see a play, you should walk out of it just thinking that the rest of your life you're going to be a director. Something okay, like that's that. Like the highest level of audience participation. Okay, you know,
okay.
You should walk out of that and just say, okay, I'm throwing really over my job. I'm just going to become a director, and because this what happened there was so important to me. I do wonder about, to return to that, you know, was that show energy that high? I mean, were you just incredibly lucky that the play that you went to
I had never seen a play before.
Oh, so it's
you know, it was just everything about it was overwhelming and magical.
Okay.
Yeah.
So one thing we can hope, some of you out there may never have seen a play. So if you can go to a play, then that's another very high thing. Mm. Underneath that is maybe something more like, not I'm going to change my whole life and become a director, but something has happened to me emotionally in some way. I have worked and thought and felt about the, and I have somehow taken in something new or rearranged myself or had some insight into myself through going to this play.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm taking that with me, and I will never be the same again, presumably because you never go back to being the person you were before you saw the play.
That's right.
That's
yeah,
right.
That you energize. It changed you, or more than that. I don't think anything changes you. You change yourself.
You change yourself. But something you about know. The play. Ah, we're back to the same point you made about the actors. Yeah. The play isn't telling you how to be.
Mm-mm.
The play is opening up the opportunity for you to take a new. I like that.
Yeah.
I think that's really good.
Yeah.
I think that's very good, and that's what we try to do in this institution all the time,
mm-hmm.
where we open up the opportunity for students and staff and faculty for everybody. Presumably, to be a different person than they were through whatever mechanism it is that permits them to see themselves in a different way.
That's right.
But they ultimately have to do it to themselves.
And want to do them to themselves, yeah. And that's not theater, that's everything.
That's not theater, that's just life.
That's
but
life.
Theater is a
but,
good...
But, yeah. Theater's a good sandbox.
I think that's a good way of thinking about it. Theater is a good place in which you can try those, and maybe you're more ready when you sit down there. It's like dark. It's like a dream space. You're more ready to let yourself get drawn into some way of taking up a different view about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So everybody out there, this is what you're supposed to do now. Speaking of what you're supposed to do, we wanted to end up the show with a comment about or an action item or just some one thought to leave them about going to the theater, to leave the audience with a thought about going to the theater.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any sort of question that sort of in your mind when you go to see a play? Is it mostly what you would say, go in there and see how the energy, what it draws out from inside you?
When you go to the theater, you know, it tells you right away, you know, when the energy is greater than you are, you know, from the day you've had, from the coming off the road, then, you know, no matter how tired you were, you become refreshed.
Okay.
No matter how old you felt, you feel you can dance.
You can dance.
And that's not only theater, it can be other things. But for me, it's I'm talking
theater.
About theater.
Terrific. Well, so we encourage you to go out go out and go to the theater and dance home on your way home. So, or maybe change your life and become a director, just like
there
Peter
you go.
Did. So I want to thank Peter very much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
I really
for having
enjoyed
me.
It. It was an interesting conversation. And I just want to remind everybody that you can listen to this again on UCDpodcast.com, OfficeHourUCDpodcast.com. Let's say it twice correctly. OfficeHourUCDpodcast.com. There will be an archive of the show will be up, and there will be a link to Peter's website so you can find out more about his articles and go see some shows, and certainly go see some theater would certainly be an action
I'm
item.
Yeah, I'm doing a production of Grimm's Tales at the end of the month.
End of February, Grimm's Tales.
Yeah.
So I hope you all go out and see that. In the meantime, we'll be back next week with another interview. We'll knock on somebody else's door. And meanwhile, stay tuned for Radio Theater, which is coming up and now, and we'll be back next week. Bye.